You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The hit Netflix series Ozark is back for a third season, and not surprisingly, the Byrd family, headed up by Jason Bateman and Laura Linney, find themselves drawn even deeper into a ruthless drug lord's empire, just as they're struggling to go legit. But then, as if they need another headache, everyone's lives are thrown into chaos when her brother, Ben, comes to town. The brother with a bad past is played by actor Tom Pelfrey, and today, Tom joins me on the podcast to talk about Season 3 and what it's like to work with Jason Bateman both as an actor and as a director. He also discusses his upcoming role as legendary Hollywood director Joseph Mankiewicz in David Fincher's film Mank. He recalls his early days working on the soap operas As the World Turns and Guiding Light, what it's like keeping up with the grueling production schedule of daytime television, and how it requires an actor to memorize fast and think on their feet. He discusses the learning curve involved with switching from soaps to film and primetime television, his popular roles on the hit series Banshee and Iron Fist, and who is more obsessive, Marvel fans or soap opera fans? Coming up with Tom Pelfrey in just a moment. Folks, you know actor Tom Pelfrey from Netflix's Iron Fist, as well as Cinemax's wildly popular Banshee. Now he's joined the cast of the hit Netflix series Ozark in the third season. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ben, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're doing this interview remotely, of course, due to the coronavirus lockdown. Tom, where are you calling in from right now?
I am currently calling you from the Catskill Mountains, somewhere in the Catskills.
Oh, nice. Nice. Catskills. Yeah. That was like the big place back in the day for like Jewish vacationers from New York and everything. What are Grossinger's and all those places?
Yeah, I think that's still the idea. I do not have good internet reception in my home. So I'm currently snuck into the back room of a friend's place so I can enter and leave at my own discretion.
Nice.
So practice. Social distancing and using someone else's Wi-Fi simultaneously.
Now, are you usually based in Manhattan?
Yeah. I'm always in New York. I have an apartment in Brooklyn and just upstate right now to try and help with, I guess, keeping the numbers as low as possible in New York City.
Yeah, good man. My brother and his wife and kid are in Manhattan, and God, it sounds like New Yorkers are pretty scared right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a very unique set of challenges to be facing, I suppose, and with the obvious population density in New York City, the way the city's built, that's.
Now, I don't know if this makes it any easier, but I read here that you're no stranger to being quarantined. At some point, I think when you were starring on the daytime drama Guiding Light, you were exposed to mercury and had to be quarantined. Is that true?
Yeah. One of the thermometers broke on one of our sets, and the FDNY showed up and quarantined us all for a bit to keep us safe. But that was a minor blip on the on the radar. Nothing at all compared to this.
In fact, I think you got your start in daytime soap operas like Guiding Light, and then As the World Turns. I'm curious. I don't know too much about that world, but who were your characters on those shows? Did you ever come back from the dead? Did you ever have an evil twin?
I never had an evil twin. I did come back from like a fake death. My character on Guiding Light was called Jonathan. You know, it was my first job out of college. Great learning experience. The thing that most people might not know about working on a soap opera is that you're filming 60 to 65 pages a day.
Yeah.
So you're producing an hour of television every day, which is insane. To give an example, like a show like Ozark, where the episode is about an hour long, you'll have at least 8 filming days to get an hour. Obviously, the quality of the production is insanely higher and better than on the soap opera. But yeah, when you're filming a soap, you're doing about 60 pages a day. It's a crazy, crazy speed of work. So you develop some really good skills and some really bad habits.
Yeah, that's brutal. I mean, that's harder than doing theater.
Well, it's definitely a different set of challenges.
Yeah.
You know, you have to learn how to memorize fast. You always have to show up prepared, and you have to get more and more comfortable with making choices kind of instinctually and shooting from the hip, because there is no time to really do preparation or work. And that's interesting, because that can give you certain qualities that might be helpful in the future. It's also a little bit dangerous, because what you really want to be doing, I think, is being able to spend as much time with the material as possible and work in a way that you're going deeper and deeper, and that it just, because it isn't an option on the soap, it takes your brain a minute to reset when you leave the soap and go, oh, slow down.
This may show how out of date I am, but I don't know. Do they still shoot soap operas live anymore? Or are they all
No. Those days were gone even by the time I got there years ago. But man, talk about pressure. I mean,
God, I can't even imagine. Well, I wonder, was it hard for you to cross over from soap operas into primetime TV and movies? Did you find that a lot of casting directors wanted to sort of pigeonhole you at first?
Yeah, at first. And I totally understand that. I don't think it's done with any malice. I think that, you know, it just takes a minute to sort of develop a new idea about somebody. And so, yeah, it took a minute, but also it took a minute for me, because like I said,
really,
I learned a lot of good things and had a great time on the soap, but I had to adjust the way I was working to broaden my own horizon. So yeah, I think that was like a natural process of me learning, and also people giving me space to grow.
Interesting. What kind of, I guess, habits did you have to break, or new habits that you had to form when you transitioned?
Well, again, the main thing was just slowing myself down, because I'd gotten so good at working fast. Like, for instance, when I first came on the soap, I think my first day of work, I had to film maybe like 10 pages or something. And I probably spent 2 weeks learning those lines, and was a little bit nervous the day I was there to film that I might not remember them. Juxtapose that with, you know, I was on the soap for 2.5 years. So after 2 years of being there, they started doing these episodes where the entire character would be in every scene in the whole episode. And so you would have like 60 pages of dialogue. And because they knew how quick I could do those things, they, as a kind of challenge, filmed my entire episode in one day, and I was fine.
Wow.
So yeah, it's just a muscle. It's just a muscle in your brain. And I worked it to the point of it being very strong. But then the problem is, when you have the luxury of really spending time with material to work in a deeper way, to let things sit, to not rushing towards a result, which is what you have to do on the soap. That was the biggest adjustment for me. It's like, just slow down, just calm down. There doesn't need to be a result here. This is a process, you know?
Yeah, now I saw that you also did a movie with another former guest of the show that I just love, Dick Cavett. I adore that guy.
Oh.
Isn't he the loveliest guy in so many stories?
He sure is. He sure is. What a gentleman. Mm-hmm. You know, the right use of that word. What a class act. He was such a kind and dignified, and his eyes just sparkled, you know. He's that beautiful human being. It was an honor to get to meet him and that whole group, actually. That was some pretty special guys.
Oh, yeah. You had, Jerry Stiller and some other
pretty Jerry Stiller and Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
Jerry Stiller. I remember the first read-through. We were sitting there at the table, and there was, like, a spread of things, and we got done reading, and Jerry started preparing a plate of food, and they said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I've got to bring some food home to my wife, or she'll kill me."
I love it. I mean, that's straight out of Seinfeld right there.
yeah. No, that was a really cool job. That was, you know, one of those times where you just keep your mouth shut and your ears open and try and learn as much as possible.
Yeah. And I also know that you starred in a Broadway production about another Hollywood legend, End of the Rainbow, which was later turned into the film Judy, starring Renee Zellweger.
Yeah.
You played Mickey Deans, Judy Garland's last husband.
I did.
Now, he's kind of been portrayed as a bit of a douchebag, right?
Total douchebag.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say that he might have enabled her addiction, or at the very least didn't do much to stop her self-destruction. What do you think? Was he just a hanger-on? Do you think that he actually cared for her? Was there more to him in that whole relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think with most relationships, it's probably a lot of things simultaneously. I do believe on some level he did probably care about her, but yes, mostly the way I see that is that he was a hanger-on, and he did like the attention, and I think he did like the amount of control he had over her. Mm-hmm. At that point in her life, she was extremely vulnerable and not well. Mm-hmm. Not well at all. And when you read the stories about the way that Judy Garland was treated when she was a child, I mean, she was 12, 14 years old, and these studios are giving her pills, diet pills, pills to get her energy up, pills to let her go to sleep, and no adult is intervening on her behalf. So all of the people, I mean, you know, you give these drugs on a regular basis to a child who hasn't even gone through puberty yet. It's like, well, what do you think that's doing to their mind, to their brain, to their physiology? Like, when you really understand what happened to her, it's a miracle she was as, you know, successful as she was, and it's tragic, but she really wasn't well by the time she was with Mickey, in my opinion. I think he was her fifth husband.
Yeah. Well, more recently, you were a fan favorite on the hit series Banshee, on which you played a neo-Nazi named Kurt. As an actor, how do you go about getting into the headspace of a neo-Nazi? How do you get into that kind of dark place?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. In terms of Kurt in particular, the idea was that he was he had left the Nazi movement. Like, he was sort of a reformed Nazi. And so the thinking then for me becomes, yes, I read some books about neo-Nazis to kind of understand the mindset and the culture and what's really happening when those people proclaim to believe the things that they believe. And then you have to think, okay, well, then what does it mean for someone to be that indoctrinated and then leave? So, like, kind of focus a little bit more on, like, what must have happened to change someone's mind about the way they're living their life. Because it doesn't matter whatever it is you're doing. I think we all know as human beings that we sort of resist change. So for someone to make that big of a change, it's like, that must be a central part of who that person is. If they can be so extreme as to believe in such a disgusting ideology, and then so extreme in the other way that they then want to become a police officer. Obviously, the world of Banshee is kind of like a fantastical world, like a graphic novel, not quite based, like a heightened reality world, which is fun. But still, you're like, wow, that guy has extreme polarity. if he can go from that extreme to the other, and like, what is that in that person?
Having played that character, has it given you any insight into what we've seen with the resurgence of neo-Nazism and white nationalism over the past few years?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, the thing that struck me when I was reading certain memoirs or books about white nationalists written by ex-white nationalists was that it's not really that so many of these people necessarily actually even believe in what they're saying. Mm-hmm. It's that they're afraid. When people get scared, they become more tribal. And unfortunately, if you're mixing in fear and anger with ignorance, you know, and ignorance in the sense of like, you know, one of the books I was reading, the man who was writing the book said that he had never met a black person.
Wow.
He had never met a Jewish person.
Wow. In
you know,
America.
And so
it's amazing.
Well, yeah, but this is the thing with sometimes it's literally just not understanding that what you're talking about is a human being who has infinitely more in common with you than they have different from you. And it's really powerful. Actually, recently I was listening to an interview with a I forget the guy's name. He's a black jazz musician. He was being interviewed on Joe Rogan. And over the past like 20 years or so, he has converted like 200 different members of the Klan to leave the Klan. And the amount of times he said that he would sit down and cultivate a friendship with these people who in theory hated him, but the amount of times he said that they told him that that was the first conversation that they were ever having with a black person, I mean, just goes to show you the level of which so much of this hate is just ignorance. It's just misguided feeling. It's just lack of experience, you know? And so it's scary and it's sad, but I believe that it is ultimately far outweighed by people who share and understand and are seeking to understand and reach out. You know, it's just a very frightened, a very scared, a very fearful mindset.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, I mean, hate begins with dehumanizing another person. And, you know, it's harder and harder to do that if you actually have a one-on-one experience with another human being. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. Right now, companies, governments, and pretty much any organization are being stalked by cybercriminals. And at some point, when the time is right, they will be successfully attacked by malicious actors seeking money, retribution, or political gain. Afternoon Cyber Tea with Ann Johnson provides insights for CISOs and key security decision makers who want to empower themselves with the information to ward off cyber attacks and the disruption they cause. Each week, Ann Johnson, Corporate Vice President for Cybersecurity Solutions at Microsoft, talks with the nation's top cybersecurity thought leaders and influential experts about what they're seeing and doing. She and her guests cover topics like election and national security, diversity in the cyber industry, and how a culture of information sharing is one of the best defenses. Join Ann to explore the risk and promise of tools and systems powered by AI, IoT, machine learning, and other emerging technology. And get ideas for strategies that can head off intrusions from malware to man in the middle. Afternoon Cyber Tea is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Podcast One. Subscribe now. Well, on a lighter note, you also got a lot of attention for your role on Marvel's Iron Fist. It must have been quite an honor to now be enshrined in the Marvel Universe, huh?
Yeah, that was pretty wild, man. That was an interesting experience, just being, however temporarily, inside the sort of the Marvel machine a bit. The levels of secrecy and special emails that you needed to open scripts and passwords and
really, they're that careful, huh? Because fans are obsessive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what they pointed out, because they have such a enthusiastic fan base, they felt that they need to take certain precautions, which at times felt a bit extreme, but then again, what do I know, you know? So,
well, Well, my question is, who are the more obsessive fans, soap opera fans or Marvel fans?
Oh, soap opera fans.
Really? Did you get women proposing to you by mail and stuff, housewives and whatnot?
I had it explained to me once. I cannot take credit for this idea, but I had it explained to me why that might be. And I think psychologically it makes sense, is that the soap operas are on 5 days a week,
right,
every week of the year, every year. So like you are seeing that person, that actor, that character, whatever, on your TV, in your living room, every single day. It's something new. There's never reruns. The show is never not on. And so I think it lends itself to a feeling of familiarity that is, well, it just makes sense because of the repetition of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. An hour a day. In some cases, women may be spending more time with you than their husbands. I don't know.
Let's hope.
Well, I mentioned at the top that you're the new series regular in season 3 of Netflix hit drama Ozark. What has that been like?
Well, that job is just a dream job. I told Jason and Chris Mundy before I left that they'd ruined me for life. But, you know, I'd watched season 1 and season 2. I was a big fan of the show before I knew I would have anything to do with it. I got to audition for the role of Ben and got the job and was so excited. And, you know, so as a fan of the show, I obviously see the quality of the show. I love the world. The actors are incredible. The writing is amazing. It's inventive and dangerous, but also very funny. It's like the perfect, it's the kind of world I love to watch as an audience member. And then you get there, and on top of all of these things, everybody who works there is incredibly kind and respectful. The atmosphere on set is very calm, very supportive, very peaceful, very creative and safe. And so across every possible dimension, the job was good. And that almost never happens. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a huge... I mean, the credit there, I believe, has to go to Chris Mundy, the showrunner, Jason Bateman, Laura Linney. You know, these things start from the top down, and all of these people are just incredibly kind, gentle human beings. Mm-hmm. And they have, I think, very purposefully curated an atmosphere on their set, which, in my opinion, lends itself to getting the best work possible out of everybody present. You know, like I'm there in season 3, and you have crew members making plans to spend the weekends doing stuff together. And I'm like, man, after 3 years and we're spending all week working, you still want to spend your day off with these people? They're like, yeah, we love everyone here. And it's like, okay. So this entire set, this entire crew, this entire atmosphere has been carefully curated on purpose, and because of the way that everyone is treated, everyone feels loved and safe and respected, and it just brings out the best in everyone. It was just truly a pleasure to be there.
Yeah. And I have to think that a lot of the credit goes to Jason Bateman. This has kind of been his baby because he stars in it, he produces it, and I think he's now directed something like 8 episodes. What's he like to work with as a director?
Yeah, he's so smart. I mean, you can just tell he's been doing this for a long time, and he's a real professional. As a director, he's so easy. He's so gentle. You almost forget that you're filming, because obviously he's been an actor since he was a young boy, and he understands what an actor's job is and how to make it easy for an actor. He's also obviously a very talented actor, and as a director, he's super, super smart. He's a smart storyteller. So when you're working with him, it's like the best of all possible worlds. You have a director who's incredibly intelligent about storytelling. Simultaneously, he's a really talented actor who appreciates actors and the craft and understands how to talk to you in a way that sometimes, you know, not all directors understand the best way to talk to an actor, but Jason can do both. And so, yeah, working with him is pretty special. It's also pretty wild. You know, you'd be in a scene with him and a few other people, and in which he's also directing. And to see him sort of give everyone notes, give the camera notes, keep an eye on the camera movements, adjust himself as the actor in the scene, and then in between takes, he's joking and playing around. It's like one of the most incredible levels of the ability to, like, soft focus I've ever seen. Like, he was keeping so many things in his attention simultaneously, and I never once saw him get ruffled. Like, he never, I mean, forget raising his voice. Like, he never, it seemed like his pulse never rose above.
Really?
Like a calm resting. Yeah. It was so impressive. I mean, and the amount of work you do, and, you know, to be a director on a show like that, the amount of preparation that you have to do.
Oh yeah.
It was really impressive. Not only that he could do all that so well, but that while he was doing all of those things well, he was so calm and friendly. It was kind of a very singular experience.
Yeah, he comes off as a really, really nice guy. And I don't know if that's a lot of the characters that he's played over the years or what. But, you know, the general public's impression is that he's somewhere between, you know, Tom Hanks and Jimmy Stewart in terms of likability and niceness.
Yeah, he is. And I think that's about right. I mean, the thing I say to people that ask, what's it like to work with Jason Bateman? I'm like, he is exactly the thing you would hope he would be. You know, he is that guy, and he's incredibly kind, and he's also very, very, very funny. Well, you know, so yes, he's a good man. And it shows, you know, that to walk into an atmosphere where the entire crew is feeling that way and working that way, I mean, it really is rare. And it is a reflection, I think, of Jason and Laura and Chris.
Yeah, and you play Laura Linney's brother in Ozark. By the way, I want to say that, you know, for a New Yorker, you do a hell of a job of playing a shit-kicking redneck on that show. Tell us a little about your character.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, when I even auditioned for the role, I just thought, if you'd left me to my own devices to write something that I wanted to do, I couldn't have come up with a more perfect or exciting thing to do than the role of Ben.
Yeah, and I also just love that your character gets introduced in the series in a scene where he throws a bunch of teenager smartphones into a wood chipper. I mean, what parent probably hasn't wanted to do that at some point?
Yeah, no. I think that'll be a little bit of collective catharsis. No, the writing of the character is incredible. I mean, it was just, you know, when the writing is that good, you feel like, I feel like as the actor, that it almost feels like cheating. Mm-hmm. Because when the writing is that good, you just show up prepared and do your best to stay the hell out of the way. And all of that scene, all of what made that scene special, in my opinion, was right there on the page. And so, yeah, it's, as I said, across every possible dimension, it was a really great job.
Well, I've watched the first few episodes. I wonder, can we expect that your character is going to get caught up in the family business?
Well, I definitely think it's impossible to be around the birds and not get pulled in somehow.
Yeah, it's like Al Pacino in Godfather 3. Once I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also really excited for your next project. I understand that you'll also be appearing in David Fincher's upcoming movie Mank, which is about Citizen Kane screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz. You play his brother, Joseph Mankiewicz, who was no slouch himself. I think he was a double Oscar winner, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he won twice as writer, twice as director. Yeah he was a very, very, very successful writer and director in Hollywood. And actually, as far as like the general public would go, Joe's sort of fame and success certainly eclipsed that of Herman. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that, I mean, talk about another dream job. Last year was a very exciting year, going from Ozark and working with Jason and Laura and those guys, and then getting to go be on a set, David Fincher set, who is a genius, and getting to work with Gary Oldman, which is a childhood hero of mine. So
yeah, he plays Herman Mankiewicz, awesome. Right?
He sure does. And he is incredible. I think everybody's going to be pretty happy to watch that movie.
Yeah, and I think you're right when you say that Joseph Mankiewicz sort of eclipsed Herman, because Herman Mankiewicz had Citizen Kane, and I think he was actually an uncredited writer on a bunch of films like Wizard of Oz and the early Marx Brothers movies. But Joe, he was really one of the favorite directors of Hollywood's golden age and far more prolific in terms of what did he have? All About Eve, A Letter to Three Wives, Philadelphia Story, Cleopatra, a whole slew of hit movies.
Yeah, and part of that is I won't say too much, but I think part of what David's movie is about is exploring perhaps some of the reasons why, you know?
Interesting. I wonder, do you think that the Mankiewicz brothers got along well, or was there some kind of a little bit of a rivalry between the two of them?
I don't know. I mean, some of the things that I'd read, there's a great book out that kind of talks about both brothers, and it was really informative and perfect kind of research material. But I think, like most brothers, that they really loved each other, and I'm sure that there was also, like most brothers, an element of competition.
Yeah. Now that I think about it, he did have at least one stinker. I remember, wasn't it Joseph Mankiewicz who did the movie version of Guys and Dolls, where he had Marlon Brando, who can't sing and can't dance, and he was singing "Luck Be a Lady Tonight."
Yeah. When you watch that movie, you can't help but kind of thinking that maybe they should have switched roles, or they should have let Frank Sinatra sing those songs.
Yeah. I mean, why on earth, you know, would you put him alongside Frank Sinatra? Because that even makes Brando look even worse. Poor guy.
Yeah, which almost never happens. But yeah. I think anybody trying to sing next to Frank Sinatra is going to end up on the short end of the stick.
Now, when you play a real person like Joseph Mankiewicz, do you do a lot of research into the real man, or do you like to come to a part with fresh eyes?
Yeah, I think with anything you do, you want to do as much research as possible, but then you always just keep in mind that the most important part, in my opinion, of any project is the script. You know, like that's the bones of what you're doing. Like that's the foundation and the baseline of what you're doing, so that you want to, I think, do whatever research or preparation that you can do in order to fully understand everything that's happening in the script. But ultimately, I think the work wants to be in service of the script, you know? So sometimes you can research a person and they can be infinitely complex and all of these things happening, but I don't think you ever want to try and force anything onto something just because you've researched it, but rather have the research and see where it helps you serve the storytelling. Sure. Because obviously it's never going to contain all the things that you find out in your research.
Yeah. And what was it like working with David Fincher? Because I don't know if this is just by his film choices, but I get this impression that he's kind of a kooky, maybe even a kind of a dark guy. But again, that may just be from the kind of movies he makes. I don't know.
Oh yeah, no. He's a wonderful sense of humor.
Really?
He's a super intelligent person, and he has a great sense of humor, in my opinion. And I loved it. I adored him. It was obviously kind of almost surreal to be getting to work with somebody like that, who's a real master at what they do. And so, yeah, that was a pretty special experience. But no, he's actually wonderfully intelligent and bright and smart, and you can tell he really loves what he does.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big old Hollywood nut, so I can't wait to see that movie. Tom, it's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Yeah.
Folks can catch you in season 3 of Ozark, available on Netflix beginning March 27th, and look for Tom Pelfrey and David Fincher's Mank in theaters this fall, assuming theaters still exist in the fall.
Right.
Tom, thanks for talking with me. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks again to Tom Pelfrey for coming on the show. You can see Tom in the new season of Ozark, streaming now on Netflix. Again, look for him in Mank, coming out this fall, and follow Tom on Twitter at Tom Pelfrey. Times are tight right now. So what would you do if your computer broke and wasn't covered by warranty, or you suddenly needed electrical work on your house? Do you have enough saved up to take care of sudden emergency expenses like those? American Home Shield, America's most preferred home warranty, gives you a plan when stuff breaks down in your home, stuff insurance doesn't cover, and stuff you don't want to mess with or go broke trying to get fixed. Go to ahs.com/kick today to save $50 and start protecting your home and budget from inevitable breakdowns. That's ahs.com/kick for $50 off any plan. American Home Shield. Be sure with Shield. Limitations and exclusions apply. See plan for details. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.